Welcome to the Essential Knowledge Update podcast from the Royal College of General Practitioners. My name is Dr. Sally Higginbottom, and today I'm interviewing Dr. Barbara Noble, a GP and educator in Wolverhampton, about the module she recently authored on asthma. Hello.
Hi, Sally.
So asthma's a big topic. Who's this new guidance from and what does it cover?
Well, it's from SINE and also from the British Thoracic Society, and it covers the management of asthma for both adults and children.
Okay, so it's a big topic and we'll try and focus down on the changes rather than the more familiar stuff, if that's okay.
Yeah.
So asthma is something we manage every day. I see this from the module, there are concerns we could manage it better. Is that right?
Yes, it is. Apparently there are 1,000 deaths from asthma each year, of which they've, after auditing it, they feel 90% are associated with preventable factors. And also asthma is responsible for an awful lot of A&E attendances, of which they feel 70% could be avoided if there was early intervention when people started having symptoms.
Okay, so we've got avoidable deaths and avoidable A&E attendances. So this sounds like there's something we could all learn from this. What criteria do you have in mind when you're thinking about asthma?
I think the thing is with asthma, it's a clinical diagnosis. But you think of it when somebody presents with wheeze, breathlessness, cough, chest tightness. And that makes you think that it could be asthma.
So a characteristic history is the first thing. What tests do you do if you think someone's got asthma in primary care?
You will do serial peak flows in adults, but of course you can't do that in children.
How old do you find children have to be before they can manage a peak flow test?
I think it's very difficult. I think it all depends on the child. Personally, I'd have thought about 10 or so, but it just really depends on the child.
So under 10s, and certainly under 8s, it's very difficult to get any sort of reliable peak flow. So yeah. Particular diagnostic traps, aren't there, with children?
You need to look at the history. If a child's got symptoms from birth, or there's a family history of some sort of unusual chest disease, you might think of cystic fibrosis. If they've been premature, there's rarer things like chronic lung disease or prematurity. If the child's got a persistent moist cough as opposed to wheezing, again, you'd be thinking of cystic fibrosis, maybe bronchiectasis. If they're vomiting a lot, think about reflux. And if they've got sort of paroxysmal coughing leading to vomiting, just think of pertussis.
So there are a set of differentials we should bear in mind. The children that get wheeze every time they get a virus, we often see the under fives with this sort of presentation. How do we differentiate those from the children with true asthma?
I think it's difficult, actually. I think it's usually in retrospect that you can see that they were just viral wheeze as opposed to asthma, really.
So we have to sort of wait and see a bit. How do you find that goes down with the parents when you try to explain that slightly wait-and-see approach? Because I'm often asked, has he got asthma? You're giving me an inhaler. Does this mean he's got asthma? Well, how do you find that works in practice?
You just have to be honest and say you don't know whether they've got asthma. Often certain things in the family history, if other children have had asthma, if either of the parents have had asthma, they're much more accepting of the fact. And often you can sort of say, even if they have got asthma, the chances are it might get less as they get older.
So there was an additional test mentioned in the guidance that I have no clinical experience of, the fractional exhaled nitric oxide. Is that something you've ever used clinically or have access to?
I'm afraid not. And the first time I ever heard of it was writing this guidelines.
Fine, so it doesn't appear to be in wide practice yet, though it might be coming. And parent and adult patients often ask about allergy testing in asthma. The guidance mentions skin prick testing. Do you use that at all? Is that something we should be doing more of?
I've never used it before in children, but I think it's possibly something if you've got a difficult to manage child and they've been referred to secondary care, that secondary care might then decide to refer on for.
The only situations I've encountered in real life with that has been related to pets, where people need to know if it's the cat that's making them worse and that sort of thing. I really enjoy the guidance's quite pragmatic diagnostic plan, that we sort of suspect it's asthma, treat it as asthma, and if they get better, then that means it was probably asthma. Is that how you find it works in practice?
I think so, yes. But of course, you've still got the viral wheeze. You might get better as well.
Indeed, yes. Can we prevent asthma in children? I'm sometimes asked, what can I do to stop him getting asthma?
I think there are a few things we can advise parents about. One is breastfeeding. That is meant to help prevent asthma. Keeping the child's weight down as well helps. And also the parents not smoking. A lot of parents will say, oh, well, you know, I don't smoke around the child. Even if they smoke, it can still affect the child.
So how do we monitor asthma? Those of us who work in areas with cough got used to the three questions from the Royal College of Physicians. Is that still what we're recommended to use?
Yes, the guidelines do recommend that the Royal College of Physicians three questions, you know, have you had difficulties sleeping due to your asthma in the last month? Have you had your usual asthma symptoms during the day at all in the last month? And has your asthma interfered with your usual activities? And then for each of these they've scored yes on, you give them 1 point if they've been having one or two a month, days like this, 2 points if it's once or twice a week, and every day, three, so they can have a maximum of 9 points.
Okay. I mean, I think I find in practice that I'm not too fussed about the score, but asking the questions can be quite informative because some of our patients have got so used to their asthma symptoms that they say, well, yes, of course I've had my symptoms every day, or of course I wake up at 4 a.m. to take my inhaler, and they've normalised that, whereas we're aiming for no symptoms, aren't we, that they're completely well without noticing their asthma. How do you find it works when you're talking to patients?
I think you're absolutely right. They do expect to have some symptoms. And as you say, what we're trying to do is get them symptom free.
Yeah, so that's about managing patients' expectations to actually be a bit more demanding about their asthma treatments, to get them to a point where they're not having to stop what they're doing or wake up in the night. So thinking about treatment, non-drug treatments, there's a relatively limited set of options. I see we're not advised to use air ionizers essentially because there's no evidence they work. But breathing exercises are back in. Can you tell me a bit about those? I don't think I've ever referred anyone for breathing exercises.
When I was doing the guidelines, I had a look to see what these breathing exercises were. And they're actually based on yoga type breathing exercises. So it maybe isn't that so much that we're going to be referring to physiotherapists, but advising people to go and look at doing yoga. It slows down your breathing, apparently, yeah, when you do it.
So we're all quite familiar now. It's been there for a few years now, this stepped management of asthma with a sort of ladder approach, starting PRN bronchodilators and then inhaled steroids, adding in long-acting beta agonists and then other treatments. Was there anything new in terms of how we do that ladder in this guidance?
I think the main difference in this guidance is making sure that you give the lowest level of steroids.
So we're looking for the lowest effective dose.
Yeah.
And we should be stepping up and down more. There's some new and exciting treatments mentioned in the guidance. What do we need to know as GPs about what's coming or what our patients might come out of hospital on?
Omalizumab, if I've pronounced it properly, which is a monoclonal antibody. This is useful for patients who are taking a very high dose of steroids, apparently. And it can be used for adults and children, and it's an injection. They're now looking at immunosuppressants like methotrexate, but this is very much tertiary care.
But we might find our patients on systemic treatments like they might be for inflammatory bowel disease or other inflammatory conditions, which would be a change because we're used to it being mostly an inhaled treatment plan for asthma, aren't we?
Yeah, I think these will be very few and far between, these patients.
Yeah. And as you say, under secondary or tertiary care.
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay. One of the things that really struck me in the guidance, which I hadn't thought much about, was that the prevalence of occupational asthma. And it's not something I've been reliable about asking. Was there anything in that surprised you?
I think for me, it was just thinking about occupational asthma. What it sort of said is, think about any patient who's maybe had asthma as a child, got much better again, and then starts wheezing again. Don't just think, okay, their asthma's come back. Think about, could it be occupational asthma? And this is often a case where you would be using skin prick testing.
Right, but often very specific allergens from the person's workplace. That's something, after I read your module, that I started doing more, is asking, so what are you exposed to at work? Which I haven't come across any new and exciting allergens yet, but I will keep asking. And how about pregnant women? They always worry me with asthma. Is there anything new about how we should be treating them?
You need to monitor them quite closely because obviously you've got two patients. And so if the mother is starved of oxygen at any time, it's going to affect the baby. You just treat acute asthma as for non-pregnant patients, but any acute severe asthma attack in pregnancy is an emergency and you need to get them to hospital. And also, if somebody is on theophylline, you need to be checking blood levels as well.
Okay. And on the subject of acute asthma, the Friday afternoon duty doctor call when you've got an acutely wheezy, coughing, unwell patient in reception, we're all relatively comfortable with the oxygen, salbutamol, ipratropium, prednisolone. Is there anything different about how we treat an acute asthma flare in the community?
I don't think there's anything different, but the guidelines do give quite good guidelines on how you can assess whether somebody is seriously ill with asthma. Maybe that's something we know anyway, but it is the sort of, you know, life-threatening asthma is altered conscious level, exhaustion, arrhythmia, hypertension, sinus. I think most of us know that. But for instance, silent chest is something that can really throw something. I saw somebody the other day who'd been seen by the ambulance service and had been given a nebulizer, and her chest was clear, even though she was very short of breath. So they said, you better go and see your GP, you've got no wheezing. And she managed to stagger around in a taxi and just about collapsed. And she was so bad that she wasn't getting any air entry at all.
Right.
So that is something that we've got to be aware of, is the silent chest.
Yes, and the fact that particularly youngsters compensate extremely well, don't they, until the point that they collapse, and then then you're in trouble. So when I was doing this module, I think the biggest surprise and real sobering bit for me was the really high number of deaths. There's been a lot of coverage in London recently about the number of children and young adult deaths in the last few years. It's been both high and rising. What were the surprises for you, or what were your big take-home messages?
I think what is upsetting about these is the way they feel that they could be preventable. Mm-hmm. And the sort of things we need to look out for is any patient who's had a hospital admission in the last year, especially if it's been a very serious, you know, fatal admission, we need to be keeping a close eye on them. Those who are using a heavy use of beta agonists, it's a sign that their asthma is in control. And I think a lot of computer systems will flag this up. The patients are using high dose beta agonists, and so we need to be proactively contacting those patients. Somebody who's on three or more medications is also at high risk. If people just keep going to the emergency department because, you know, they're wheezing, they get nebulized, given some steroids, and then somehow or other manage to not come and be reassessed again for their asthma treatment. And patients who don't, I don't know what we're going to do about them, those who don't attend appointments, people who, psychiatric illnesses, anybody with drug or alcohol abuse, tranquilizer abuse, so people with learning difficulties, and those with social problems.
I'm really struck if I think about the patients I've got who have asthma, which is very difficult to control. They're often from families who have extreme levels of difficulty across a whole number of domains, where there is smoking and drug use, where they live in very poor housing, which has mould and a multiple set of reasons why these children in particular have really difficult to control asthma, many of which feel like they're slightly out of my control, things I can't fix. But it certainly made me think again about how assertively we should be managing these particularly high-risk children and adults. So thank you very much for that. And thank you for listening to this Essential Knowledge Update podcast from the Royal College of GPs.